The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. I am Bill Donahue. I'm taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 15th day of April, 2018. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. As always, we've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, the former closer for the New York Mets, Skip Lockwood, joins us, and we'll be discussing his new book, Inside Pitch. In the second half, we'll welcome in former outfielder, first baseman for the Dodgers, Expos and Cards, Ron Fairley. His book is titled Fairley at Bat. So sit back, relax, enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We certainly have some great stuff ahead for you in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. My first guest was a pitcher for the Seattle Pilots in 69, the Milwaukee Brewers from 70 to 73, the California Angels in 1974, and we, of course, remember him with the New York Mets, 75 to 79, and the Boston Red Sox in 1980. He's written a new book titled Inside Pitch, My Life as a Major League Closer, and I welcome to the show tonight Skip Lockwood. Skip, good evening.
Bill, how are you? Very nice to be with you tonight.
It's great to have you with us, Skip. Well, doing my homework, Skip, I see that you and I have something in common. We're both college graduates, only you graduated from MIT.
I think I'm the only graduate from MIT to play in the major leagues. Someone told me that.
Yeah, I believe that's probably true. Yeah, and one other thing I see, Skip, is that you're an accomplished candlepin bowler. Now, explain to the folks what candlepin bowling is.
I think that's overrated.
Okay,
that was a few years ago. Candlepin bowling is an exercise in frustration.
Okay,
it's big tall pins and a little bitty bowling balls, and that was years ago in Norwood. I don't think I could get the ball out of the gutter these times.
Well, you were quite an accomplished athlete in high school. You got 14 varsity letters in 4 years. You were a track runner. Tell us a little bit about your high school career.
Well, I went to an all-boys Catholic high school in West Roxbury, Massachusetts. And, you know, sports was king, you know, back then. If you were an athlete and you played on the varsity team, you know, it means that you wouldn't get detention too often, and you might get a little bit of better Latin lesson or algebra lesson than the other guys got. I ran track and played a little basketball and, of course, baseball. But we didn't have a field. The field that we played on was across the way. We had to drive to it at Kelly Field in Roslindale.
Okay.
So we used to drive over there. We had to scrape the field and rake the field and everything before we got a chance to get on it. I enjoyed high school. High school was immensely good for me. It brought me into manhood. It's kind of a funny story about running track. We didn't have a track field. So we used to run indoors, down the hallways.
Uh-huh.
And so we would practice starts, because I was a sprinter. We would practice starts in the hallway, and there was two of us abreast, and only one could get through the doorway, which was 10 feet ahead of us.
Oh,
so I ended up having a pretty good start when I was running track, only because I had to beat the guy next to me. I got hung up in the doorway with him.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I
see that. Was great. This was before the draft. Now, Bill, we didn't. The draft came the year after I signed. So when I signed a professional contract, we had people came in. The bird dogs would would scout a little bit, and then the dental managers would come in and take a look at these kids. So they had a network of scouts all over the country.
Well, you signed. Go ahead, Skip.
I signed as an infielder.
Right.
Bill Enos was the guy in Boston. He Bill lived until he was 100, I think. He's a beautiful guy, but he was scouting me, you know, since sophomore year and everything. And he used to smoke cigars. I never saw him without a cigar. And I think what he did is, I think he promised my father a case of cigars if he could be the last one in to get a chance to sign me. So the A's came in at the end. I ended up getting a little bit of money, which was a good thing, because I signed as an infielder. Right. I wasn't a very good infielder. So it was a good thing I got a little money that kept me around long enough so I could make the transition to pitching.
I see. Now, we're speaking to Skip Lockwood tonight on Sports Talk 1240. When and how did you convert to pitching, Skip?
Well, it was a necessity. I couldn't hit the curveball. I was swinging at the balls and taking the strikes for a couple of years in the minor leagues. My vision was real bad, and so I had a lot of trouble trying to hit it at night. I would try to wear contact lenses, and that whole thing with trying to see the spin on the curveball. I was never very good at that. So I was lucky. Charlie Finley stuck with me. He gave me a contract, kept me in uniform, continued to pay me while I made the transition to pitching. And that was a godsend for me, because it wasn't for him, I would have been out of baseball completely. But I did. I made a conversion. They taught me a windup. I could always throw pretty good. I could throw hard. But, you know, throwing strikes and learning how to wind up and getting a breaking pitch you could throw for a strike, all those things were new for me. I had never done that before.
You tell some great stories, of course, in the book, Skip. One is about meeting the great Jesse Owens.
That's true. Yeah, when I was in spring training with the A's, I was running laps back and forth in the outfield, just, you know, trying to stay in shape. Spring training was, you know, be in shape and get there early and stay there late kind of thing for me when I was a rookie. So I was pretty much alone trying to run sprints back and forth. I was an infielder. And as a guy in a track suit was running with me, he was faster than I was. In fact, he would turn around and talk to me. He was running backwards faster than I was running forwards. And I didn't know who it was. And so I got to talking to him, and he was a deep thinker. He was talking to me about why I was running and what did I think about when my feet were touching the ground. And, I didn't know. I didn't know the answer to any of his questions. And so we had a long discussion, a long talk about running and the purpose and how the ground was on fire. And you didn't want your feet to touch the ground, and you wanted to lean into you wanted to run towards, not away from. And he was very philosophical with his approach to me. And I found out later that this was Jesse Owens. I mean, he introduced himself as Jesse, but I didn't know who Owens was. And come to find out, he had come to Bradenton, Florida, just to help me and Bert Campanaris, Campy, get better at stealing bases. And Charlie Finley had sent him down there just to work with us. Wow. So what a privilege and honor that was to have a guy like that who'd been through so much, he'll come down and talk to me about running.
What a great story, Skip. Yeah. And you also come up with some great stories about the immortal Charles O. Finley, his promotions, the mule. Talk a little bit about Charlie O.
Now, Charlie O. Finley was a showman. He was in the era of Bill Veeck, you know, with guys, you know, we're trying to get people to come to the ballpark and doing anything we could to try to get, you know, people to come in. It was a family game. They were trying to get, Charlie had a menagerie of animals just as a walkway into the ballpark in Old County Stadium. They had fireworks. They had cow milking contests. They had Farmer's Day. They did everything they possibly could to try to get more people to come into the ballpark. One day, Farmer's Day, one of our players decided that he would feed amphetamines to the monkeys. Now, they had a cage full of monkeys.
Oh, man.
And the people, you know, guys were walking in with their families, and mom and dad holding hands with the kids, and the monkeys had been fed amphetamines like an hour before. And so by now, the monkeys were ticked off, and they were out of control. They were trying to pee on the people. They were trying to break through the cage. It was incredible. And he did it, so. The mule had trouble. That the whole stadium was just a mess in this one particular Farmer's Day that Charlie had.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I can imagine that scene, Skip. Holy mackerel. Now, you talk a little bit about Satchel Paige in the book as well.
Yeah, Satchel, when I was with the A's, my locker was back by the bats in a back corner. It was in the clubhouse, but it wasn't really in the mainstream. And one day my name had been moved almost all the way out of the little slot above my locker. And another name had been put in there, Paige. I didn't know who that was. And they had moved my stool over, and they had put a rocking chair in next to where my stool was, over by the bats in the corner. And here comes this very slender, tall, he must have been 59 or 60 years old, black man. And he sat down next to me. He introduced himself, Satchel Paige.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, all the writers are coming over, and he's holding court in the back because he's got stories. You know, Satchel Paige had a lot of stories.
Yeah.
So he's got stories about his stories, and he's just holding court in the back. He was, he was only there for one game. I didn't see him after that, but he and I shared a locker together.
An interesting story, Skip, definitely. Now, you were selected by the Seattle Pilots, who, if folks don't know, were only in existence for 1 year in 1969, selected by the Pilots in the expansion draft. Now, during that season, with Boughton on the ball club, he wrote the book Ball Four. What can you tell us about Ball Four and Jim Boughton?
Well, I'm in the book.
Okay.
So, I made the book. I think Jim Boughton was an altar boy. A Boy Scout, because the stuff he wrote about was very tame compared to that team. That was a crazy ball club. By definition, it was all the people that the other teams didn't protect. So the
it
team
was like a Dirty Dozen team, type ball club.
It was a Dirty Dozen. We had guys in uniform that they were 1 foot into retirement. We had trouble fielding an all-star. Because every team had to have an all-star. And we didn't have anybody that was hitting 200, I don't think, and the pitchers were all losing. So we had trouble. I think Mike Hegan finally got the nod, and I think he was hitting 210 at the time to be an all-star for my team. Jim Boughton didn't write the good stories. He just wrote the stories for the book. There's a lot of other stories that were there that he never got hold of.
Okay. Interesting. Very interesting, Skip. Now, Skip Lockwood spends the next 4 years with the expansion franchise in Milwaukee. The Pilots move to Milwaukee and become the Brewers, who play the New York Mets today. You were a starting pitcher. Talk a little bit about your time with the Milwaukee Brewers.
Well, I love Milwaukee. We moved there. We lived there. It was funny. When I went to the Seattle Pilots, I was just making the conversion from infield to pitcher.
Okay.
And so I was, on the infield trying to field ground balls during spring training. And Rich Rollins was the third baseman for the Brewers at the time. For the Pilots at the time. So he and I were, chasing down these ground balls. And the pitching coach told me to get out in the outfield with the rest of the pitchers. And so I said to Rich, I'm a pitcher. He gave me a very odd look. I ran out of the outfield with the pitcher. That's how I found out I was a pitcher.
There you go.
Coming to Milwaukee was a chance to be in the expansion franchise. The team was young. Everybody together was pulling for each other. It was a great community. Dave Bristol was the manager of that team. Del Crandall took over as manager of the team. West Stock was the pitching. These guys took me out under their wing. I'm a newbie. I don't know a windup. I thought his foot was supposed to be on top of the rubber. I never knew it was supposed to be in front of the rubber. I had so much to learn in a brand new league to learn. They were patient. They let me pitch. They let me. I think I was 5-12 one year. I don't know. I can't remember. No, I was terrible. But they kept putting me out there. They kept on having faith in me. And I love being in Milwaukee. I love the city. I love the people. It was a little chilly.
Yeah.
But it was a chance for me to find myself in a major league uniform.
Mm-hmm. And speaking with Skip Lockwood tonight on the show, you go to the California Angels, Skip, and you encounter a couple of Hall of Famers. There's Nolan Ryan on that ball club, and also the skippers, Whitey Herzog and Dick Williams. Any interesting stories about those guys?
Frank Robinson was on that team, too.
Ah, okay. I didn't see that.
Frank Robinson, yeah. Well, first of all, Nolan Ryan threw the ball harder than any human was ever supposed to throw a baseball. I saw him pitch a no-hitter against Detroit. It wasn't fair. It was like the JV and the varsity. It was just not it was not fair. He had a curveball that was sharp and hard. The fastball you could hardly see. Nolan Ryan threw awfully hard. One of the things that impressed me when I was with California was Bobby Valentine was with that ball club, and he was coming back from a terrible horrific break in his leg when he was with the Dodgers. Mm-hmm. And he was coming back to the team, and you could see, there was a knot the size of a baseball on his shin where the bone had broke. It was grotesque. But he came to the ballpark early so he could run and work out so nobody would see him in pain. And then he'd do the regular workout and everything when the player showed up. But he was an exercise in courage. Bobby Valentine is an inspiration for me and many others. He was a guy that fought through pain to stay in that major uniform. I don't think I've ever seen a guy as dedicated and strong-willed as Bobby Valentine was.
Wonderful story there about Bobby V, for sure, Skip. Now, you go to the New York Mets, which is where we remember you by, and, of course, it was the darker times in the franchise's history, 77, 78. The dark years with Lee Mazzilli, guys like that. Now, Yogi Berra's the skipper when you come over, but he doesn't call you Skip, does he?
He didn't know my name.
Yeah.
I had never met him before. I didn't know anybody on the field. If you read the book, you'll find a funny story in there about that. When I got to the mound, I thought it would be rude to shake his hand, because everybody's watching. But this is Yogi Berra. I'd never met him before. And so he says to me on the mound, he says, "Well, what's your name, son?" And I said, "Skip." He said, "Okay, Chip." He said, "No." He said, "Listen, I want you to throw strikes." And he went through a litany of things he wanted me to do, which was cute because he called me Chip the whole time. And then he proceeded to go to the dugout. He's yelling from the dugout, "Throw strikes, Chip. Come on, Chip, throw strikes."
Yeah.
And John Stern was a catcher. And he looked at me and he said, "Dude," he said, "your name's Skip, isn't it?" And I said, "Yep." He said, "Okay." That was the opening for my season in New York. Was quite hilarious.
Typical Yogi Berra, definitely. And there's the story. I don't know if you're referring to this story with Herb Norman, the clubhouse man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great story.
He took me to the wrong bullpen. Yeah. Everybody's dressed alike. I don't know anybody on the field, so I started to say hello to everybody. But it happened to be the Montreal bullpen that I was in.
Oh, boy.
And not the Mets. Yeah. Herbie was a prankster. He was always doing something.
Herb Norman the clubby, definitely. Now, the Mets have some great pitching when you get there with Seaver, Kuzman, Matlack. And really a good staff rounded out.
Well, we had wonderful pitching. First of all, Bob Apodaca was the closer. I mean, we didn't have closers. Pitching, the bullpen pitched by committee, out in those days. So when Tug McGraw left, he went to Philly, they didn't have anybody they could really rely on to come in at the end of the game. But Apodaca was doing a pretty good job. We had good starting pitching, Seaver and Kuzman and Matlack, and those guys could, they were workhorses, so they weren't going to let you come in the game. unless you could really save it for them. And so I got a chance to pitch, and I got a chance to pitch receiver, and I got a couple of saves. I threw the ball hard, and I was getting guys out. That was the only reason. I mean, we didn't have any job security. Nobody had multi-year contracts. So you pitch from day to day, from game to game, and if you didn't pitch good, you didn't play the next game. So when Seaver, you know, requested me to pitch in this particular game, the end of the 75 season, was a privilege to get a chance to have his confidence. And I ended up, you know, winning the role as a closer for the next couple of years. But it was because I threw hard and I could throw strikes. Well, we had great starting pitch. I used to drive to the ballpark with Tom, and he used to take me in. And the day that he got traded, I didn't know he got traded, so I was waiting for him to come pick me up. And nobody came. Nobody came to the ballpark. Nobody came to my house to pick me up. So I called in to find out what was going on, and the telephone operator at the Mets told me, well, Tom's not here anymore. He got traded to Cincinnati last night. And I said, oh, no. Now I'm late for the ball game. Now I'm trying to drive myself in the traffic. And they all, we lost a lot. And they lost Tom Seaver from the ball club. And he was the heart and soul.
Sure was.
Of the ball club.
And he sure was.
He missed a lot.
Yeah, that was a dark day in the dark days of the New York Mets. Now, the late, great Rusty was on the ball club when you were there.
Yeah, the Grand Orange.
Uh-huh.
Rusty was a beautiful man. And you got to know him better after he retired. I mean, he did so much for the police department and the widows from 9/11 and everything. I knew that beforehand. Rusty was very fastidious about everything he did, you know, from the uniform to how he prepared to the ball game. And he was a guy that was very meticulous about everything he did. And he preached that. He would say to me, you know, how are you going to pitch to this guy? How are you going to set up that pitch? And do you know if he's going to be following, you know, a certain guy in the batting order? His precision and how he had approached the game was very contagious to everybody in the clubhouse. I just loved the man. Sorry that he passed last week. We lost a good friend, but what a tremendous competitor. What a gracious, elegant man, Rusty Staub.
Definitely. Borderline Hall of Famer for sure, Rusty Staub.
Absolutely.
We're speaking with Skip Lockwood tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You go to the Red Sox, Skip. You run into a couple of more Hall of Famers there. Fisk, Perez, Rice, Yaz, Eckersley. That was a pretty good ball club.
Well, you know, it was a good ball club, but it wasn't New York. And we had lived in New York now 4 or 5 years, and I had gotten I was used to having a real strong clubhouse, and guys all rooting for each other and pulling for each other. And I didn't find that in Boston. It was my hometown, so I was coming back, you know, to where my mom and dad lived and my friends from high school and stuff like that. But the ball club itself wasn't pulling together. I think you probably read the article they had in the Boston Globe called 25 Cabs.
Right.
And this was talking about you couldn't get a cab, somebody to share a cab with from the airport trying to get to the hotel. I enjoyed playing with Fisk. I liked Eckersley very much. I still do. There was two or three guys that I really adored. Carlton Fisk is one. I still see Carlton Fisk a lot. Great guy. But the team didn't seem to pull together, and Zimmer and I didn't seem to get along. I wasn't pitching very well. He was trying to trade me, and he made no bones about telling me that he was trying. Every day he'd be saying, I couldn't trade you again today, so you're still here.
Yeah. Boy, yeah, what a welcome. Yeah.
No, he was
Gee, the gerbil.
Gerbil.
Bill Lee called him the gerbil.
That's what Bill Lee called him. Yeah. I still see Bill Lee all the time. I didn't play with Bill.
Yeah, I've had Bill on the show, Skip. Yeah, he's unique, let's say that, right?
If you want stories, Bill Lee's got stories.
He does.
He's got stories about everything. He's like expert in everything around.
Who was the favorite catcher that you had to throw to, Skip?
Well, I thought Cotton was really good. Quick story about Cotton Fiskin. In Chicago, I was pitching mop-up. You know what mop-up is. It means that when you're pitching, nobody else warms up, and you're just mopping up innings. Mm-hmm. And I was pitching for Mike Torres, came out in the third inning. And I was pitching in Chicago, and I wasn't pitching real good. And they were hitting home runs, and I'd walk a guy. Another guy hit a home run. And it was just one of those games. It was not a Hall of Fame game. And in Chicago, if you know, they blew fireworks off. Every time a home team guy got a home run, shoot off fireworks on the scoreboard. So
right, and you know, all Comiskey, yeah.
Yeah. So the fireworks going up and the fireworks coming down, and I'm out there, and Carlton Fisk comes out to the mound, and the both of us are standing on the mound looking at the fireworks. There's nobody warming up, so I'm still going to be pitching. So I said, Carlton, you know, what are you doing out here? And Carlton says to me, he says, you know, Skippy, he says, I'm going to tell you the truth. He said, the only reason I'm out here is to make sure that scoreboard has time to reload.
Oh, man. That's
and
a,
I could
that's
hear him.
One.
I could hear him laugh all the way when he was running back behind home plate. I could hear him laughing all the way back.
Now, was he your favorite teammate, Skip, or who was your favorite teammate through all the stops you made?
That's a hard question. I still think the world of Tom Seaver. Tom taught me a lot. I was a raw piece of clay, and he helped me mold into becoming a thinking pitcher and becoming more thoughtful about my approach to the game. Tom and I got very close. I talked to him this last winter when they had the fire
out
of Calistoga, where his winery is and everything. I think my favorite teammate has to be Tom Seaver.
Excellent answer, and for all the right reasons, Skip. So what keeps Skip Lockwood busy these days?
Well, I've got four grandchildren. And
nice.
I chase them around a bit. I'm doing some writing. Inside Pitch is a book I've been working on for a few years. I'm very, very happy to have Tom on the cover and Rico on the back cover and an endorsement. I got a foreword for Burgess and Jenkins.
Sure you did.
That?
Yeah, that's great.
This is a soulful, beautiful man that I've known for years offered to write the foreword for me for my book. I'm so privileged to have him do that for me. I just can't tell you. I might work on a sequel to the book. The book seems to be doing real well. I'm pleased that it's... You know, I think the book is a book that you can read if you're a coach.
Yeah.
If you've got a little league team or a high school team. I try to take the reader out with me on the field, so I think coaches could use it as a kind of a mindset. Instead of pitching batting practice to your little league team, maybe put up a mirror so they can see themselves bat and they can get an idea of what they look like when they're successful. The book was fun to write. I enjoyed doing it. Let me do another one.
Excellent, Skip. Well, I tell you, my wife's got it now, and she's enjoying it, so she thanks you, too. So, Skip, the book is entitled Inside Pitch, My Life as a Major League Closer, Amazon.com. Look for that book and pick it up. You'll certainly be entertained. It's been a real pleasure having you with us on this Sunday evening, Skip. I thank you for taking the time out to be with us.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
You take care, Skip. Skip Lockwood, folks. Next up, we'll talk to former big leaguer Ron Fairley. Stay with us, folks.
You are listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your Gust Buster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on GBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Sunday evening. I got to tell you, the Mets train keeps a rolling. They lost one, but they pick up another win today. Syndergaard mowing down the Milwaukee Brewers. Wilmer Flores, the hero this time with a walk-off home run. Mets win. The Nats come in tomorrow night, and hopefully they can keep the momentum going. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. My next guest was a first baseman outfielder for the L.A. Dodgers, the Montreal Expos, St. Louis Cards, Oakland A's, Toronto Blue Jays, and California Angels. He was a two-time All-Star and a three-time World Series champion. His book is titled Fairly at Bat. He either played in or broadcast over 7,000 Major League games from 58 through 2006. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Mr. Ron Fairley. Ron, good evening.
Hi, Bill. How are you this evening?
I'm doing well, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm out here on the West Coast, and the weather is beautiful.
Yeah, you're loving it. It's it was nice for one day here, and it's back to winter. So
it's gonna get better soon.
You know how it is in the Northeast in April.
Yeah.
No good. So you were born in Macon, Georgia. You grew up out in Long Beach. Who were your favorite teams and players when you were a kid, Ron?
Well, at that particular time, we had the West Coast teams. We had the Hollywood Stars and the Los Angeles Angels. They were a Triple-A team.
Right, right.
And at that particular time, we only read about the Major League teams because the furthest team west was the St. Louis Cardinals. But I did have my favorite teams. I watched them during the World Series between the Dodgers and the Yankees for so many years. And so I had Dodger and Yankee fans were my favorite. I love Stan Musial.
Yeah, great choice.
Yeah.
Stan the man. Now, you played varsity baseball for Ron Dado at the University of Southern California. He was a real classic man, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. I believe that, Rod won, I think, 11 national titles while guiding the Trojans. And I think he's had probably more ballplayers sign professional contracts than any other school in the country. He had a lot of us that were out there. And of course, Seaver went there. Dave Kingman went there. Freddie Lynn, myself, and just many, many, many other guys.
A who's who of great major leaguers. Yeah, he certainly had a great program running out there, Ron. And Rod Dado, certainly a great baseball man. Now, Pat Gillick. You were a teammate of Pat Gillick's, right?
Yes, I was.
And Pat Gillick's a Hall of Famer now, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's another one. It's kind of slipped my mind real quick. But, yeah, Pat was on our ball club. And, of course, everybody knows what Pat has done during his professional career. And, of course, I worked with Pat a little bit up there when I was broadcasting for the Mariners. And Pat was the general manager.
Exactly. He's a Hall of Famer and deservedly so.
Yep.
Now, one of the stops you made, of course, your first was with the L.A. Dodgers. You made that club in September 58, and you're one of the few players to play 1,000 games or more in the outfield and the infield, each infield and outfield. What was your preference, Ron?
You know, I like first base better because there is more action.
Okay.
You're involved with more plays. I mean,
right.
Any ground ball that's hit, you have a chance to make a play at first base. In the outfield, I had some games I didn't have a ball hit to me.
Yeah, that's so pretty boring.
It gets
kind
of boring out there, but you asked me which one I preferred playing. I preferred playing first base, but like I said, there's more action. You get involved in the game more.
Now, do you remember your first career hit?
Yes, I do.
And that
was off Robin Roberts.
The great Hall of Famer, Robin Roberts. Yeah, what did he throw you?
Well, it was a fastball. He's primarily a power pitcher. And I played in the game before that, and I went 0-3. And during that game, all I kept saying is, don't strike out. Just don't strike out. Well, I didn't strike out. And in the second game, I had three hits against Robin Roberts. Went 3-4.
Nice. And your first home run was off Ron Klein, a guy who pitched for the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yeah. It was kind of funny about that home run. In Pittsburgh, at Forbes Field, it was short down the left field line. It was only like 310 feet. But the fence went out very abruptly to 375.
Oh, yeah.
And in that game, I hit one right down the line. It was about two seats fair and about maybe three rows deep. So I probably hit the ball. It was about 320 feet at the most.
Yeah, but
later on in the game, Duke Snider hit one in the upper deck over the right center field fence. He probably hit it about 450 feet. And the next day in the newspaper, the writer said that we each hit our home run in the same place. Well, I don't know which home run he was walking and watching.
Maybe he meant Forbes Field.
After reading the article about five times, I felt stronger.
Yeah, and like they say, in the box score, everything looks good, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
You got that right.
We're talking to Ron Fairley tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, you helped the Dodgers win the pennant. You hit .238, but you had four homers, 23 RBIs. You won the pennant on the way to the 59 series. What do you remember about that World Series, Ron?
Well, it was the Go-Go White Sox.
Right.
Yeah, and we thought the Yankees were going to win in the American League, but then the White Sox played really well the last couple of weeks of the season. The Yankees fell off just a little bit to allow the White Sox to sneak in there. And so we opened the World Series in Chicago, and the first game they beat us 11-0. And holy cow, what in the world did we walk into? Because we weren't really, I don't think, really prepared to play the White Sox. And then after that, we got hot and started playing well. And it went six games. Larry Sherry ended up with two saves and two wins in the World Series. And Duke got hot. Duke Snider got hot, hit some home runs. So did Wally Moon. Chuck Cicci did two pinch hit home runs in that series. I did not start any of the games, but I played in all six games.
Right, which is pretty good. Not bad at all. Now, in 63, you had a very good year. 271, 12 homers, 77 RBIs. You play the Yankees in that World Series.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, our pitching staff was pretty dominating. There isn't any question about that with Koufax, Drysdale, Padres. Johnny Padres was a big-game pitcher. If the game didn't mean that much, well, you don't really know what you're going to get out of Johnny. But if it was an important game, Johnny would pitch an outstanding game for us, and that's exactly what he did. In fact, the tune-up game, we were playing the Phillies at Dodger Stadium, getting ready for the 63 World Series. And Johnny lasted 1 2/3 innings. And he gave up about six or seven runs. And when Alston went out to the mound, he says, "How do you feel?" And Johnny says, "Get me out of here. That's the heck with this tune-up stuff. I don't need this stuff. I'm ready to face the Yankees." And sure enough, it came in the second game there at Yankee Stadium. And Johnny ended up beating the Yankees, I think, by a score of 4-1. He only gave up six hits and one run. And he went like 8 1/3 innings.
A real big game pitcher. He came in big, folks may remember, in 55 for the only World Series the Brooklyn Dodgers won while they were in Brooklyn, of course. Johnny Padres, certainly a big game pitcher. Now, 65 run, you win the pennant again. The World Series this time is against the Minnesota Twins, and this is Koufax's World Series, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, at the very start of the World Series, right at the beginning of Yom Kippur.
Right.
And so there was a big discussion. Do you pitch Sandy, on Yom Kippur? Well, it didn't make any difference to us. We had Drysdale. Drysdale was a 23-game winner. So what difference do we start Koufax or Drysdale? It didn't make any difference to us. So we started Drysdale, and he got his brains beat out in the first game. In fact, Don only went about three plus innings, something like that. And Austin out there on the mound, and when Austin came out to take Don out of the game, Drysdale says to him, he says, "I bet right about now you wish I was Jewish."
Yeah.
That was the only thing we had to laugh about in the first game.
Yeah.
And then Johnny came back and won the next game. What was interesting, or no, lost the next game. What was interesting about that World Series, the first two games were pitching to a lot of their strengths. The scouting report that we had was not a very good scouting report. And Gil Hodges, of course, was with the Dodgers. And Gil was Drysdale's roommate. And he says, "Let me see that scouting report. How are you pitching these guys?" And we were pitching to some of their strengths. Just one guy, for an example, Jimmy Hall, said we could throw him fastballs and keep him down and hit him on the ground a lot. And Hodges says that Jimmy Hall was one of the better fastball hitters in the American League.
Oh, boy.
I mean, stuff like that. So we went to L.A. We changed our pitching a little bit. And then Claude Osteen won Game 3, and then we were right back with Drysdale and Koufax. And we won all three games in L.A. And then finally that went back to Minnesota, lost to Jim Mudcat Grant. And then in Game 7, Koufax with only about 2 days rest, about 2.5 days rest, he went out there on the mound, and the question was whether we're going to start Koufax or Drysdale. And Alston decided we're going to start Koufax because it took him longer to warm up. Don could warm up a lot faster. So if Sandy got into a jam, Don can warm up a lot quicker and bring him into the ballgame.
Interesting.
Well,
yeah.
It turned out Don was up in the bullpen a couple of times. But then Sandy, like so many games that I watched him pitch, he struggled in the early innings. And then later on in the ballgame, everything seemed to smooth out. Sandy was throwing harder in the 7th, 8th, and 9th inning than he was in the first 4 innings.
He had the best stretch of those 4 or 5 years as any pitcher ever, didn't he, Ron?
There's no question about that.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no question about that. And John Roseborough, our catcher, used to tell me, he says, watch Sandy when he gets into a jam. He goes through a routine. He'll go behind the mound, and the count will be something like 2-2, and it's a really crucial part of the ballgame. And he'll go behind the mound, and he'll get some rosin, and he'll adjust his jersey or something, and then walk back up on the mound and adjust his cap and then look in. He says when he goes to that routine, there's a good chance it's going to be a fastball. It's not going to be an ordinary fastball. And sure enough, I've seen enough times where Sandy would go behind the mound and do his routine, and bam, here comes a fastball that the hitter hasn't seen yet. And Sandy threw the ball consistently at 96, 97 miles an hour. That was just a consistent one. But then he would reach back and he would add on to the fastball, and he'd throw one up there 101, 102. And the hitters would turn and say, "Well, now where'd that pitch come from?"
Yeah. And
he just overpowered guys. I remember one game we were playing the Braves, and how kind of give you an idea how Sandy would think ahead a little bit. It was in the 8th inning, and he had the 8th place hitter that came up to the plate, and Sandy really went after him hard. And in the post-game show, he was talking with Jerry Doggett. Sandy was talking with Jerry, and Jerry says, "Why did you pitch the 8th place hitter so hard?" He says, "Because if I get him out, I don't have to face Aaron in the 9th inning, because I'll have the pitcher spot and the number 1 and 2 hitters in the lineup. Aaron always batted third. So if I get the 8th place hitter, I don't have to face Hank."
Right. Good point. Always thinking that, man.
Yeah. Sandy also was experimenting with throwing a slider.
Boy,
and Sandy just threw basically a fastball, curveball, and a changeup. Not very many changes. And so he says, I'm gonna work on my slider, and I'm going to try it against Aaron. If it works against Hank, it'll work against anybody. And Hank was, I think, the best right-hand hitter I've ever seen. So we're in Milwaukee, and Sandy is pitching, and Hank comes up to the plate the first time, and Sandy threw him a slider, and Hank hit a line drive out of the ballpark foul by about 10 feet. And he turned to Roseborough and said, "Sandy doesn't need that pitch."
Wow.
And Roseborough came back and told Sandy that, and Sandy says, "If Hank says I don't need it, then I don't need it." That may have been the only slider he'd ever thrown.
Great story, Ron. Definitely, we got Ron Fairley with us tonight. His book is called Fairley at Bat. You can get it on Amazon. Where else can you get it, Ron?
Barnes & Noble is another
Barnes
place.
Barnes & Noble,
that
sure.
You can get it.
Yeah. How did you feel about... Go ahead, Ron.
No, go ahead.
How did you feel about leaving the Dodgers and being traded to the expansion Montreal Expos?
Oh, good golly. I felt like I was traded to Siberia. Good golly. First of all, I've been on a winning team my entire life. Little League, Legion Baseball, high school,
USC.
At USC.
Right.
And and then with the Dodgers, I mean, we expected to win 100 games every year. Now I'm going to go to an expansion team in a foreign country that doesn't speak English, and they expect to lose 100 games a year. That's a whole different attitude. And it took me quite a while to get accustomed to go out and play the best you can, knowing that you're going to get beat a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you're on an expansion team, there are a lot of those players that winning is not important. You just play well enough to keep your contract and come back again next year.
Well, so
winning is not that critical.
Uh-huh.
And the guys in the clubhouse will look around and say, well, compared to him, I'm doing pretty good. And compared to him, I'm doing really well. They do that comparative thing with all their stats.
Sure. Well, in 73, Ron, you made the All-Star team. You played pretty well. There were guys on that ball club. Rusty was on that ball club, right?
Yeah, the Le Grand Orange.
Yeah.
Montreal, they called him. Poor Rusty, I'm sorry, but he passed away here recently. And,
right.
Rusty was a heck of a hitter.
He was. 2,700 hits, sure was.
Yeah.
And, of course, nobody knows that better than us here in New York. And Gene Mark, quite the manager. What a long career he had.
Gene Mark was a very good manager. He just never had a really good team. He had a pretty good team in Minnesota. The one year, the Phillies looked like they were going to win the pennant. And then at the very tail end of the season, they couldn't do anything right. I think they had a 6-game lead with 10 games to go, something like that. And they almost finished third. Then he went to the Angels, and then Dave Henderson hits the home run to knock the Angels out of going to the World Series.
Right.
So, but I think Gene was a very, very good manager. He came to the ballpark every day ready to manage, and he expected the players to come to the ballpark every day ready to play.
Now, I guess you finally felt that you fit in up in Montreal. And then you're traded to St. Louis.
I was happy to get, you know, one summer. It was a week before the 4th of July. It was June 28th. And we had a night game, and I went after the game, and I went to a place to have a sandwich. And when I came out, it was snowing. And I'm saying, what in the world am I doing playing a week before the 4th of July, and it's snowing?
Wow.
That was one of the things that I kind of laugh at now. Someone said, Ron, what kind of a summer did you have? And I said, I hit 667. I was 4-for-6. Summer lasted 2 days.
Yeah. Sure. Understood. Now with St. Louis, you run into two more Hall of Famers, Brock, Shane Deans, and our broadcaster here, Keith Hernandez, was on the club.
That's right. Keith was there. I helped him out a little bit around first base. Keith, obviously, he had talent, any question about that, and he could flat hit. And so we talked a little bit about playing first base and some of the things that you need to do around the bag. Haven't played there quite a bit myself. And Steve, and he was a very, very, very receptive. So I wish him well. I'm glad he had such a great career. Good for him.
Good for Mex. Yes. Now, you began a very successful broadcasting career in 1979, Ron.
Yeah.
Really long career. You must have made an impact somewhere along the line there.
Well, yeah. Good golly. I mean, I have the best seat in the house up there in the radio or television booth. I talk about the game, and I got paid for it. That's a fantastic job.
Why not?
And of
right?
course, I had a
yeah.
chance to work with Dick Genberg and Don Drysdale with the Angels, and then work with Hank Greenwald with the Giants, and then up to the Seattle Mariners and work with Dave Niehaus. And then, of course, I think some of the most fun time I had up there was when Pinella was the manager.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's a colorful character.
I
Yeah.
Oh, I loved Lou. I mean, he would go through a whole bunch. Every day I'd go into the clubhouse and go into his office, and he'd be putting the lineup together, and he would say the same. He would ask me these questions. Lou would say, "Well, let me ask you this. Would you rather have," when he's working on his lineup.
Yeah.
He said, "Would you rather have our first baseman or their second baseman?" And then I'd give him an answer. "Now, would you rather have their second baseman or our second?" And he'd go around the whole field. And it turned out that there was always five or six players I'd rather have on the opposing team. And then he threw the pencil down on the table and said, "Well, that's what I mean. You see what I see, and how do you expect me to win when the other team has more better players than we do?"
Right.
Yeah, and it was perfectly logical. I mean that we went through that. But
sure.
He also, at the same time, Lou would tell me about Steinbrenner when he was there.
Oh.
And there are a couple of times that I got a big kick out of that. Lou was managing one day, and they're playing the Brewers, and Tommy John is pitching against Don Sutton, and the phone rings. The clubhouse man brought the phone all the way from the clubhouse, long extension cord, and said that Steinbrenner's on the phone. And Lou says, "I'm at the ballgame. I'll call him after the ballgame." He says, "No, if you don't answer the phone, I get fired." So Lou had to take the call. So Steinbrenner gets on the phone, and he gets all over Lou. He says, "Lou, what in the world are you doing? You're killing me out there. I don't know, whose side are you on? Why aren't you out there arguing? Sutton's out there on the mound scuffing the baseball all the time, and you're not doing a darn thing about it. I mean, whose side are you on?"
Oh,
Lou says, "George, what's the score?" He says, "Well, we're winning." He says, "That's right, we're winning. Who do you think taught Sutton how to scuff the ball? Tommy John taught him. And our guy's cheating better than he is, so shut up and don't bother me." Well, that you could hear the... you could hear the Steinbrenner hung up. That was the thing that got him.
Oh, he must have been steaming, George, yeah.
Oh, he was.
Yeah.
Until he finally realized, wait a minute, our guy's cheating better than their guy is.
Lou was right, yeah. Definitely. So, some great stories come out in Fairly at Bat, folks. Tell us, Ron, about your meetings with Ted Williams.
Ted Williams was the most domineering type of an individual I ever met. I mean, he was John Wayne on steroids, and he did not like opposing pitchers. That was the enemy. There are a couple of stories that Bob Lemon, Hall of Fame pitcher, Cleveland Indians. Lemon used to tell me that right in the middle of his windup, when I was getting ready to release the ball, I knew he knew what was coming. And he said, "I could never fool that guy." Hank Aguirre, who eventually played one year with us for the Dodgers, when he came up with the Cleveland Indians, they had him down the bullpen, and they brought him into a game, and he warmed up, and the first batter that he faced was Ted Williams. And he dropped down with like a 2-2 count or something, dropped down sidearm and threw him a breaking ball down low and away, and Ted swung and missed strike three. The next day, the Cleveland players were going to have some fun with Aguirre. They gave him a baseball and a pen. He said, why don't you go over and ask Ted to sign the baseball and tell him that you struck him out yesterday if he wouldn't sign the ball? And Aguirre says, you think he'd do that? And he says, yeah, go ahead, do that. So Hank went over and went to Ted and says, "Mr. Williams, I pitched against you yesterday and struck you out. Would you please sign the ball?" Ted says, "Yeah, I'll sign it." So he signed the ball. That same day, they game late in the ball game, and they bring Hank Aguirre in to face Ted Williams a second time. And he says, "Oh, I know how to pitch this guy. Let's drop down and throw him that little sidearm curveball."
That's all.
He says, "I threw that pitch down there, same pitch." And he says, "It wasn't that Ted hit the ball so far as it got out of the ballpark so fast. It was about a 430-foot line drive over the right center field fence. And as Ted is rounding third base, he says to Aguirre, 'Have your teammates get that ball. I'll sign that one, too.'"
Oh, man. Yeah, I can imagine the splendid splinter. Yeah. Never missing a beat.
Yeah, yeah. But the whole book is about stuff like that. It's stuff that you never read about in the accounts of the game. It's things that went on the field and off the field, what we did after ball games and everything. And no, it's not a Jim Bouton book. I think you're going to find enough funny things in there that you get a good chuckle out of. For an example, we're
we had Pete Rickard. Remember the left-hand pitcher that went on to Baltimore for about 8 or 9 years?
Pitched against the Mets in the series in 69, sure.
Yeah, okay, you remember. You know Pete. Mm-hmm. Well, he was our long man in the bullpen. And the only time Pete would go out would be the night before Koufax pitched, because what are the chances that Koufax is going to get knocked out of the game in the first 3 or 4 innings? So, sure enough, he went out one time, and it was a hot afternoon there in L.A., the temperature above 95 degrees, and Sandy's in trouble in the second inning. And they get Rickard up in the bullpen. Sandy gets out of the inning. Third inning rolls around. Sandy's in trouble again. They get Rickard up for the second time. Austin goes out to the mound. I was at first base that day, and so the three of us are standing on the mound. And Austin says to Sandy, how do you feel? And Sandy says, it's better than the guy you have warming up. So with that, Austin just turned around and walked back off the mound. We came back, scored a bunch of runs. Sandy ended up being the winning pitcher.
Nothing you can do about that, yeah. Oh, some great stories in this book, folks. It's called Fairly at Bat. Ron Fairly, the great ball player, the great broadcaster. And I think I told you via email, Ron, you were in the first ball game I ever saw at Shea Stadium when I was a kid.
The first one?
The first one. Dennis Bennett opposed Bill Singer that night.
Holy cow.
1967. Well,
that's going to jog my memory a little bit. Dennis Bennett was tough on left-handers.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was tough. And then Billy Singer had a good sinker. And I think Matt slipped a little spinner in there now and then, because Drysdale taught him how to throw one.
Ah, okay.
All those little things. That now you're jogging my memory there.
Yeah, that's okay. We all need a little jog now and then, Ron.
Yeah, I need a lot of jogging sometimes.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight, Ron. I appreciate you taking the time out of your Sunday night to be with us.
Bill, thank you very much. I love baseball, and I just had a bunch of stories that I felt that I should write down, and maybe somebody can appreciate them and get a kick out of them.
Well, you hit a home run with the book, Ron. Very entertaining. We enjoyed it, and we enjoyed speaking with you tonight.
All right, Bill. Thank you.
Take care. Ron Fairly, folks. Well, that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Skip Lockwood and Ron Fairly. Of course, my engineer, the immortal Brian Graves. And, of course, you folks for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number 2 on Sports Talk 1240. I'll see you next time. Until then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.